the desperate, all-or-nothing struggle to maintain a habit in the face of unceasing official vigilance. Always on the scout for new venues, I smoked in freezers and storage lockers and steam tunnels. I joined the classical music club so I could smoke in the bathrooms of the concert halls we visited, and went out for cross-country so I could smoke while running in the woods. I kept a store of spearmint lifesavers to mask my breath and used a holder so my fingers wouldn't stain. It was fretful, laborious work. But when I took that first deep drag, I went dizzy with pleasure, not least the pleasure of getting away with it one more time. Then I almost got caught. I'd been smoking in the basement of the chapel with a boy who was discovered there by the chaplain just minutes after I left. I was putting music in the choir stalls, my chore that week, and my excuse for being there, when the two of them came upstairs and walked down the aisle. The chaplain, sad but decided, holding the boy by the elbow. And the boy. I could only glance at him, and then I looked away. But I saw enough. For the rest of the afternoon, my gut clenched at the approach of any master. I was afraid the other boy had given me away. Well, not to save himself, no chance of that. But in a fit of clear-cutting confession, or resentment at my escape. He didn't, though. He went out the gates alone. I had seen his face. I knew what was happening to him. He was in free fall, and still trying to believe he was only in a dream of falling. He lived in New York, and it would be a long night's ride for him on the train, by himself. I could easily see myself on that train. My journey wouldn't stop in New York, though. I'd have to catch the gritty Century to Chicago, then change to the Great Northern. Day after day of rolling past factories and fields and deserts and mountains, but seeing none of it. Gazing at my own stunned reflection in the glass, as every click of the wheels took me farther from school. Lying sleepless in bed that night, I saw my school as if from an impossible distance. Heading across the plains in a darkened railway car, back to the melancholy and muddle of life with my father. I pictured the black-beamed dining hall loud with voices, the chapel windows blazing red on winter afternoons, the comradely sound of the glee club practicing, the scrape of skates on the outdoor rink, a certain chair in the library, the deep peace of the library, the faces of my friends. I saw the school as if I'd left it forever, and the thought made me sick at heart. I got up and collected my suicide kit of cigarettes and lighter and holder from their hiding places, and went to the bathroom at the end of the hall, and stuffed it all into the trash can. I never smoked at school again. But the temptation was persistent. And sometimes I could almost hear the old crew puffing away in the basements and attics. So my first thought when the sirens came wailing up the drive that Sunday afternoon was that one of those poor fiends had started a fire somewhere and would pay the price that very hour. Who would it be? I was coming out of the library. From the top of the steps, I could see a thick braid of smoke twisting up over the old field house. Thrill-starved boys poured out of the dorms and halls, with a few masters trying to form them into groups, or at least slow them down, all to no effect. I followed, my notebook under my arm. I had been holed up most of the weekend, trying to finish my poem for the competition. What I had been working on was a hunter's elegiac meditation over the body of an elk he's killed after tracking it for days through the mountains. This wasn't typical of my poems, abstract and void of narrative, as they tended to be. It fell into the pattern of a group of my stories in which a young fellow named Sam evaded the civilizing demands of his socialite mother and logger-barren father by fleeing into the forests of the Pacific Northwest, where he did much hunting and fishing and laconic romancing with free-spirited women he met on the trail. I had begun this series innocently enough, in unconscious tribute to the Nick Adams stories. But over time it had evolved into something less honest. I wanted to be taken for Sam by my schoolmates, who knew nothing of my life back in Seattle. But this poem was giving me a headache. For one thing, how was the hunter, having trailed the elk so far into the woods, going to get it out? How big was an elk, anyway? Really big, I guessed. So, after offering thanks to the spirit of the elk for giving him all that meat, the hunter was going to look ridiculous walking away with one lousy haunch over his shoulder. Maybe I should have made it a regular deer. But deer didn't have the majesty of elk. There was a lot to fix, and the poem was due the next morning. The day had turned cold. A storm had blown off the last of the leaves a few nights earlier, and the bare black trees made it seem even colder. I fell in with a younger boy, a fourth former whose recent submission to Troubadour we had not yet rejected, though we probably would. I kept waiting for him to ask about it, but as we approached the fire, he got excited and ran ahead without a word on the subject. The crowd had gathered around the old field house at the near end of the football field. The firemen stood by their truck, drinking coffee and taking turns with the hose. No flames were visible, though I could hear the water seethe as it hit the roof. The shingles had burned through here and there, exposing a sheet of charred subroofing that sent up a greasy hiss of smoke as the firemen played the hose over it. I asked the boy next to me how the fire had started, and without taking his eyes off the field house, he mumbled something about Jeff Purcell. Purcell? The news rattled me because this was my friend and because he'd invited me to spend Thanksgiving vacation with his family in Boston. And now I could look forward to nothing better than another stretch with my boring grandfather and his boring wife in a housing development outside Baltimore. False alarm. It wasn't my Purcell, little Jeff, who'd started the fire. It was his cousin. Big Jeff was a vegetarian, the only one in our class whose love of animals extended to an ugly black rat he somehow kept hidden in his room and carried around at night in a pocket of his dressing gown. Big Jeff would have been a figure of fun among us, if not for his great friendliness and his trust in everyone else's goodwill. When you did tease him, he didn't get it. He just looked at you like a puppy, wondering why in God's name you'd tied a can to his tail. Big Jeff was devoted to Purcell. He haunted his room and patiently endured his abuse, just to sit in the corner and watch him shave or do push-ups or dress for dinner, and listen to him pronounce his opinions and anathemas. He wasn't stupid, Big Jeff. He did well in his science classes, and what he cared about, he knew about. He'd made himself an authority on how animals were raised and slaughtered, and as we tucked into our roast beef, he spared us no detail as to how it got from the pasture to the plate. Big Jeff had another passion, and in pursuit of this, he almost burned down the old field house. He believed that our destiny was to leave Earth behind and colonize other planets. In our fifth form year, he'd started the Rocket Club. And though he couldn't find any members in our class, we were too busy licking our chops for a great big bite of this planet, he did manage to recruit a few younger boys out of the Science Fiction Club. On Sunday afternoons, the Rocket Club met at the football field under the eye of the chemistry master and shot off whatever they'd cooked up in the lab that week. Big Jeff had been experimenting with a two-stage rocket, but instead of going straight up, his missile cut a few loops and crashed into the fieldhouse roof, where the explosive booster detonated in a clump of old pine needles and leaves. Whoosh! I wish they'd kicked him out, Purcell told me that night. I laughed. I thought he was joking. We were walking back to our dorm after an editorial meeting. We left the brick path and cut across the grass, which was stiff with frost and rustled under our feet. I know it sounds terrible, Purcell said, but I do. I wish they'd kicked him out. Why would they do that? He didn't break any rules. Did you see him at dinner tonight? He was doing everything but taking bows like some kind of celebrity. He is some kind of celebrity, actually. Big Jeff. Big Jeff. When I was a baby, they actually stuck him in the same crib with me. It's true. They say you can't remember that far back, but I do. That hound dog face staring at me. You think I could forget that? Kindergarten. The desk in front of mine. Always fidgeting, always looking for something, always with his hand up. I can still see the light shining through his ears. Grade school, camp, vacations. Man, you don't know what it's like. Big Jeff and Little Jeff. Whatever college I end up at, he'll be there waiting in my room. We'll probably get buried in the same coffin. Me and Big Jeff. Big Jeff and Little Jeff. Ad fucking aeternum. I started a new poem that night. It was the fire that got me going. That and the firemen in their open rubber coats and high gaping boots. The looks they sneaked at us and the masters and the school itself. Pretending to let their glances skate over us, but taking it all in. Their curiosity made me look around too. For a moment, I saw this place as I had first seen it. How beautiful it was and how odd. I felt its seclusion and how we'd come to resemble each other in that seclusion. We dressed so much alike that the inflections we did allow ourselves, tasseled loafers for the playboy, a black turtleneck for the rebel, were probably invisible to an outsider. Our clothes, the way we wore our hair, the very set of our mouths. All this marked us like tribal tattoos. The firemen looked us over, and we looked them over. Visitors snapped us to attention. There was one fireman in particular I found myself watching. He had tired-looking eyes and held himself a little apart. He was less covert than the others in sizing us up. I thought about him after they finished and drove away. That was how I came to write my new poem, a narrative in which I described a fireman the morning after a big blaze. He's been the hero that night, braving walls of flame to rescue a little girl. Now it's over. He goes home, and it's Saturday morning, and his son is watching TV. He fries himself some eggs, but doesn't eat them. He's oppressed by the crumbs on the kitchen table, the dirty cereal bowls, the smell of burnt toast and last night's fish. The television is too loud. Then he's on his feet and in the living room, and he's just yelled something, he doesn't know what, and his boy is looking at him with coldness and disdain. I thought writing should give me pleasure, and generally it did. But I didn't enjoy writing this poem. I did it almost grudgingly, yet in a kind of heat, too. Maybe it was good, maybe not. Maybe it wasn't even a poem, only a fragment of a story in broken lines. I couldn't tell. It was too close to home. It was home. My mother gone, my father, though no fireman, wounded by my disregard. As I was appalled by his need. The mess, the noise, the smells, all of it, just like our place on a Saturday morning. The sense of time dying drop by drop, of stalled purpose in the close aquarium atmosphere of confinement and repetition. I could hear and see everything in that apartment, right down to the pattern in the formica tabletop. I could see myself there, and didn't want to. Even more, I didn't want anyone else to. I submitted the Elk Hunter poem. Red Snow, I called it. Frost. The day after John F. Kennedy won the presidency, George Kellogg won the audience with Robert Frost. Our paper printed his poem in a box on the front page, a dramatic monologue in which an old farmer feels the bite of mortality on the first cold day of autumn. George had used an odd mixture of tones. At one moment, the farmer is lyrically drooling over the sight of the hired girl milking a cow. Old rooster struts the rafters while the barn cat begs, mewing at her feet in the stall where Flossie stands, as with swift, hard strokes of her soft white hands, she pulls the foaming cream into the pail between her legs. Then, a few stanzas down, he's a terse fatalist. Corn's high in the silo, hay's stacked in the loft, cordwood's halfway to the roof, door cracks plugged with clay. So let come what will, hard ground, short day. I've done all I am able, and after all, the snow is soft. The poem was entitled shamelessly, First Frost. In his telephone interview about the poem he'd chosen over all the others, Robert Frost told our reporter, "Young Kellogg has had some fun at this old man's expense, and I guess this old man can stand some fun if it isn't too expensive." He said he liked the joke of the milkmaid having soft hands. "All the milkmaids I ever had to do with could have gone bare-knuckle with Jim Corbett and made him bleed for his purse." Frost suggested that a few winters on a farm wouldn't hurt any young poet to learn that snow was no metaphor, if nothing else. "But I guess I've dipped my bucket there a time or two, and your fellow Kellogg has caught me fair and square." I was astonished that Frost could have read the poem as anything but an act of fawning servility. But no, he seemed to think that George had written some sort of burlesque, that he was using the poet's manner and material, perhaps his very name, to give him the needle. Frost sounded like a man who'd been stung by a taunt, showing he could take it and come back with some chaff of his own. Still, he'd paid George the ultimate compliment of choosing the poem. How hurt could he be? I read the poem several times and began to imagine that maybe it was satiric, and thus better than I'd first thought. But George set me straight when I went to his room that afternoon to congratulate him. "What do you think of the poem?" he asked me. "I like it. Way to go. George, you're going to meet Robert Frost." "Did you think I was, how did Mr. Frost put it, having fun at his expense?" "Well, I guess you could read it that way." "You could? It's possible." "Oh, geez." He slumped like a puppet, taking no care to hide his distress. He still had his tie on, a knitted tie with a flat bottom. It looked crocheted. It looked like a doily. Our biology master wore ties like that, but George was the only boy you'd catch dead in one. He was both the oldest and the youngest of us, the most fuddy-duddy and innocent. And I could see that his innocence extended to this question of sardonic intent. His poem, alas, was perfectly serious. "But you don't have to read it as parody," I said. "You can also read it as tribute. You know, the farm, the folksy tone, the snow. It's like you're paying your respects to him, tipping your hat, so to speak." "Exactly." George sat across from me on his roommate's bed. "That's exactly how I meant it, as an homage." He looked at me with such gratitude that I couldn't help throwing another log on the fire. "And, of course, the title," I said. "You like the title?" all those layers of meaning. First frost, as in literally the first frost of the year. Then there's the symbolic sense of here comes winter, i.e. death, but also rest, right? The snow is soft, after all. After all the hard work he spent his whole life doing. Soft and white, like the girl's hands. After all, he's going to get what he wants. Unless I'm just reading this stuff into it. No, no, it's all there. Then, I said, the crowning touch. First frost, as in first. Frost, as in frost is tops. Frost is the best. Frost is number one. Exactly, exactly. But it's not just an homage. Of course not. You'd never find that business with the girl in one of his poems. Foaming cream, the pail between her legs. That doesn't sound like frost. Doesn't really sound like you either, to tell the truth. That's something of a new direction for me. He looked down, controlling a smile. I have to admit the female character got away from me somewhat. Has that ever happened to you? Someone you're writing about suddenly becomes real? Now and then. She became very real to me. This will sound strange, but I knew her. And I'm not talking about just metaphysically. It was physical, too. In fact, when I was working on her part of the poem, I found myself in a state of, you know, arousal. Has that ever happened to you? Nope. I got up to leave. Look, you should probably keep that to yourself, George. You know how immature some of these guys can be. Once a week, the Sixth Form Honors English Seminar was invited to eat dinner at the headmaster's table. He'd once been an English master himself and enjoyed our company, enough to be liable to the charge of favoritism. You'd never find him playing host to honors chemistry. He required literary conversation. If a couple of us talked up a book he hadn't read, he wrote down the title and read it himself, then put us through our paces. Dinner at his table often ran late, the headmaster forcing some booster to explain an enthusiasm he found baffling, while the rest of us, elbows planted in a waste of cups and napkins and half-eaten rolls, chimed in with our own judgments and dissents. The headmaster took the gloves off and let us do the same, a liberty we preserved by putting the gloves back on when we stood up to leave. I loved the passion, the self-forgetfulness of those nights, though more than once my swelling heart clenched at the sight of the dining hall staff, all other tables stripped and set for breakfast, wearily waiting for us to shut up so they could finish their work and go home. It was our headmaster who had persuaded Frost to visit. He always called his old teacher Mr. Frost. And a few of us tried that ourselves a time or two, until we saw the headmaster wince. Then we all understood that Frost, or Robert Frost, was fine for us, but that despite its apparently greater formality, Mr. Frost was reserved for those who could claim acquaintance. All of us understood, that is, but George Kellogg. Once George sank his teeth into Mr. Frost, he wasn't about to let go and seized any chance to say it. He was completely blind to the headmaster's discomfort, his helpless hunch and shudder at every repetition of the blunder. None of us had the heart to straighten him out. And of course, the headmaster couldn't do it without sounding ridiculous. I get to say Mr. Frost, but you don't. It was a nuance of etiquette as inexplicable as a joke, and George wasn't snob enough to get it. But now, by a quirk of fate, he was going to meet Robert Frost on his own, and afterward what had been presumptuous would become impeccable, without George ever knowing it. Purcell fell in with me outside the dining hall and declared his astonishment that George's poem had been selected. His respect for Frost's intelligence, he said, had suffered irreversible damage. "Well, George's poem isn't that bad," I said, "if you read it a certain way." "As a takeoff, you mean?" "Right, as a takeoff." "But it isn't a takeoff." "Well, it could be. That's how Frost read it." "But it isn't, and you know that." "Doesn't matter what I know." "Bullshit. It doesn't." "Let's say you find it in a bottle. You're walking on the beach, and you find George's poem in a bottle. You don't know anything about the person who wrote it. You just have the poem. You'd probably read it as a takeoff." "Frost. I don't know why I even bothered submitting anything, given how he writes. I mean, he's still using rhyme." "Yeah, so? Rhyme is bullshit. Rhyme says that everything works out in the end. All harmony and order. When I see a rhyme in a poem, I know I'm being lied to." "Well, go ahead and laugh. It's true. Rhyme's a completely bankrupt device. It's just wishful thinking. Nostalgia." "I'm not laughing at you," I said. And I wasn't. What I was laughing at was the thought of George Kellogg getting aroused over his own poem. But Purcell was offended and turned away. Good thing, too. To prove I wasn't laughing at him, I would have told him about George. He'd have told everyone else, and George would have gotten endless grief, and I would have despised myself. If, as Talleyrand said, loyalty is a matter of dates, virtue itself is often a matter of seconds. Robert Frost arrived during dinner. When he appeared in the dining hall, slowly crossing from the side door with the headmaster, gingerly mounting the two steps to the high table, the ordinary din died almost to silence. We kept eating and tried not to stare, but we couldn't help ourselves. Frost let himself down into the chair at the headmaster's right, facing out over the room. He bent his big white head as he arranged his napkin, taking his time. He seemed deeply absorbed in the problem of the napkin. He looked up, nodded at something the headmaster said, and gravely surveyed the hall. The door to the kitchen swung open, a clatter of pans, someone shouting. The door swung to, and the silence resumed. Then Dean Makepeace rose at the head of his table and turned toward Frost and began to clap. Each report of his hands sharp as a shot, but measured, decorous, and the rest of us jumped to our feet in a great scrape of chairs and made the hall thunderous with applause and the rhythmic drumming of our feet on the oaken floor. Frost gave a little bow with his head, but we kept up the racket, and finally his reserve broke. He smiled boyishly and rose partway in his chair, and waved his napkin at us like a flag of surrender. I was conscious of him throughout the meal, and held myself as though he were conscious of me. Some of the other boys at my table also suffered fits of dignity. The atmosphere in the hall had become theatrical. This had everything to do with Frost himself, the element of performance in his bearing. Even the business with the napkin, awkward as it seemed, had a calculated quality, charged the room and put us on edge, not at all unpleasantly, as if a glamorous woman had entered the hall. Frost read to us in the chapel that night. This was unique in my time at the school. The other visitors all spoke in the auditorium. Maybe it was a sign of the headmaster's special regard, or maybe Frost himself had asked to read there. Well, certainly it was the most beautiful building in the school. Famous, we were often told, for its stained glass windows, plundered from France by some sharp alum. Even at night, weakly lit, the red panes glowed like rubies. The pews creaked as we settled in. We sat somberly in place, staring straight ahead, or gawking up into the heights where the arched ceiling vanished in darkness. The iron chandeliers shed just enough light to cast long medieval shadows and burnish the bronze memorial plaques, the rich woodwork, the plain gold cross on the altar. Frost sat with the headmaster in front of the altar, hands on the carved armrests of his chair, his head bowed as if in meditation or prayer. But I was sitting near the front, and I caught the gleam of his eye under the heavy white brows. He was watching us watch him. When the headmaster finally stood to make his introduction, Frost gave a start and looked around as if he'd been worlds away, and that finding himself here was a puzzle indeed. The headmaster climbed the steps to the pulpit. He was a lanky, long-faced man with a big wen over his right eyebrow. It was a blistery-looking thing, and when you first met him, you could see nothing else. But he soon distracted you by holding your eyes with his keen, attentive gaze, and by the arresting beauty of his voice. He had a profound bass full of gravel, which he used to good effect and to his own satisfaction. When we made fun of him behind his back, we forgot the bump and mimicked his rumbling drawl.
"Purcell, you're not altogether a dull boy. Perhaps you can explain what is meant by peyote solidities or sexless hydrogen. I'm trying to understand these words, and I am failing, Purcell. I am failing."
I expected the headmaster to use this moment for a swipe at the Ginsburg-Ferlinghetti crime family, which had a few soldiers among us, though not as many as he feared. He had read their work and affected to see no difference between Howe and a Coney Island of the mine. He did, of course. Ferlinghetti didn't really matter to him, but Ginsburg he hated. Though he disparaged him in aesthetic terms as sloppy and incoherent, what he really detested was his vision of America as a butcher of souls. The headmaster was a Democrat and a meliorist. He'd been steadily adding to the number of scholarship boys, and we heard persistent rumors that he was badgering the trustees to lift the ban on black students. Perhaps he sensed in Ginsburg the herald of those descending furies that meliorism made only more rabid, that nothing could satisfy but the death of the imperfect republic, whose promises he cherished and tried to keep. He hid his detestation of Ginsburg in ridicule, quoting him with such simpering, deadly scorn.
"Moloch, in whom I sit lonely, Moloch, in whom I dream angels."
That it took me many years to figure out that Howell was a great poem. Whatever his reasons, he feared Ginsburg's influence on us to a degree that was almost respectful. Frost would serve as the perfect bludgeon. I caught Bill White's eye. We both knew what was coming. But no. Instead, the headmaster told a story of how, as a farm boy, completely ignorant of poetry, he had idly picked up a teacher's copy of North of Boston and read a poem entitled After Apple Picking. He approached it, he said, in a surly humor. He'd done more than a bit of apple picking himself, and was sure this poem would make it fancy and romantic, and get it all wrong. Yet what struck him first was how physically true the poem was, even down to that ache you get in the arch of your foot after standing on a ladder all day. And not only the ache, but the lingering pressure of the rung. Then, once he'd assented to the details, he was drawn to the poem's more mysterious musings. What was that pane of ice about? Which part of the poem was dream, and which part memory? When he'd borrowed the book, he'd had no idea where this act would lead him.
"Make no mistake," he said. "A true piece of writing is a dangerous thing. It can change your life."
That was all.
He came back down the steps. No recitation of Frost's honors and awards. No witty, polished reminiscences from the Amherst years. I had never before heard the headmaster speak of himself as someone with a particular past, and never did again. With us, it was all books and ideas, and what he liked to call, quoting Jane Austen, the complement of rational opposition. He was married, but hard to imagine in his wife's arms, because he seemed consecrated to a relationship with the world that yielded nothing to the flesh, whose unremitting satisfaction I conceived to be the point of marriage. He was a mystery to us, and, like great generals and actresses, he guarded that mystery like the power it was. He helped Frost up the winding steps, and then, instead of returning to his chair, joined us in the pews. This left Frost alone, at the front of the church, in the high pulpit. He arranged his books and some loose papers in a certain order, then rearranged them, the papers rustling loudly under the microphone. At this, he stopped to inspect the mic as if the device were new to him. He tapped it suspiciously. This produced a resounding knock, and he shied back a little. He picked up a book, rifled through the pages, set it down again, and peered out at us. "Can you hear me? You can hear me, you boys in the back? Well then, good. That's good. I suppose I should read you a poem. But I was just thinking about something Shelley said. You know, Shelley, fellow who wrote Ozymandias. It's in your books. Friend of Byron. Friend of Keats. Wife wrote Frankenstein. Anyhow, Shelley liked to say that we poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. They used to speak like that in those days, by the pound. Unacknowledged legislators of mankind. Wonder if it's true. Wonder what it means. Does it mean we're dangerous, like your headmaster says? What does your man Kellogg think? Is Mr. Kellogg here tonight? Frost waited, gazing out at us until George stood up, a couple of seats to my right. He looked furtive and damp. He looked like a sinner in a Last Judgment painting, about to get his due. And Frost. Frost looked like himself up there in the pulpit. He was standing below one of the chandeliers, whose wintry light silvered his hair and made shadows on his weathered face. He didn't look old. He looked eternal. He took George in. "So," he said, "Mr. Kellogg, that was quite a piece of legislation you wrote. Bet you had some fun with it, too, holding the old man's feet to the fire." "Good for you, good for you. Old men should have their feet held to the fire. Keeps them awake. All right, boys, they brought me down here to sing for my supper, so I'd better do some singing. There's one for you. No snow in here, Mr. Kellogg, but maybe we can find you some later on. I wrote this one when I was lonely for home, many years ago in England. I expect you boys know about homesickness. It's called Mending Wall." He lowered his eyes to read, and George wilted back into the pew. "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun." He picked his way slowly through the first line, as if the thought were just occurring to him, and then his dry voice filled like a sail, and became good-humored and natural and young. When his farmer said, "Spring is the mischief in me," I smiled, because I'd already felt the mischief at work in him as he came alive in the warm day, carrying stones to the wall, watching his neighbor do the same, struck by the pointlessness of their labor, and unable to resist teasing his neighbor about it. I had read the poem, and I thought I understood it. All walls should come down. But in Frost's voice, the scene became newly vivid, and I caught something I'd missed, that for all the narrator's ironic superiority, the neighbor had his truth, too. The image of him moving in the shadows, like an old stone savage armed. He himself was a good reason to have a wall, the living proof of his own argument that good fences make good neighbors. Maybe something doesn't like a wall, but take it down at your peril. Frost was good at masking his eyes under those hanging brows. But now and then I saw him shift his gaze from the page to us, without losing a word. He wasn't reading. He was reciting. He knew these poems by heart, yet continued to make a show of reading them, even to the extent of pretending to lose his place or have trouble with the light. His awkwardness took nothing from his poems. It removed them from the page and put them back in the voice. A speculative, sometimes cunning, sometimes faltering voice. In print, under his great name, they had the look of inevitability. In his voice, you caught the hesitation and perplexity behind them. The sound of a man brooding them into being. Frost read on. Poem after poem, until the underclassmen began to cough and set their pews groaning. Then he raised his head and took us in. "You boys are champion sitters," he said. "You've got Sitzfleisch, as our great new friends, the Germans, would say." "That's enough for one night, eh? Well, maybe just one more. What do you think? For your man Kellogg?" "Yes." "All right, then. I have just the poem here. I believe Mr. Kellogg knows it." Still looking at us, Frost recited, "Stopping by woods on a snowy evening." Then he gathered his books and pages while we applauded. The headmaster went up the steps, conferred with Frost, came down again, and raised his hand for silence. Mr. Frost, he said, had agreed to take a few questions, if we had any. I had some. How did he know he was a good writer for all those years when nobody else knew? What did it feel like to write something really great? Why did he choose George's poem? "Sir, if I may..." I looked around. It was Mr. Ramsey. He was standing in his pew. Even in this dimness, his chubby cheeks showed their youthful English bloom. Mrs. Ramsey was plucking at something on her sleeve. He had married her 4 years earlier, right out of some Southern women's college where he'd taught after leaving Oxford. She was just a freshman at the time, and Mr. Ramsey lost his job and brought her north to Putney and then to us. Mrs. Ramsey worked in the library and never lacked for boys willing to help. She wore her honey-colored hair in long, girlish braids, and smelled good, and her voice was low and pleasantly Southern. She had a teasing manner and looked at us as if she knew what we were thinking. When they arrived 2 years back, she was still in love with Mr. Ramsey. We could all see it. She hung on his voice, quoted his pronouncements. Lately, this had changed. Since October, I'd been assigned to their dinner table, and seen her look bored while Mr. Ramsey went on about something. On occasion, she turned away while he was still talking and chatted with the boy next to her. She was easy to talk to. "Your work, sir," Mr. Ramsey said, "follows a certain tradition. Not the tradition of Whitman, that most American of poets, but a more constrained, shall we say, formal tradition. As in that last poem you read, Stopping in Woods. I wonder..." Stopping by woods on a snowy evening, Frost said. He put both hands on the pulpit and peered at Mr. Ramsey. Yes, sir. Now, that particular poem is not unusual in your work for being written in stanza form with iambic lines connected by rhyme. Good for you, Frost said. They must be teaching you boys something here. There was a great eruption of laughter, more caustic than jolly. Mr. Ramsey waited it out as Frost looked slyly around the chapel, the Lord of Misrule. He was not displeased by the havoc his mistake had caused. You could see that. And you had to wonder if it was a mistake at all. Finally, he said, You had a question? Yes, sir. The question as to whether such a rigidly formal arrangement of language is adequate to express the modern consciousness. That is, should form give way to more spontaneous modes of expression, even at the cost of a certain disorder? Modern consciousness, Frost said. What's that? Ah, good question, sir. Well, very roughly speaking, I would describe it as the mind's response to industrialization, the saturation propaganda of governments and advertisers, two world wars, the concentration camps, the dimming of faith by science, and, of course, the constant threat of nuclear annihilation. Surely, these things have had an effect on us. Surely, they have changed our thinking. Surely nothing. Frost stared down at Mr. Ramsey. If this had been the last judgment, Mr. Ramsey and his modern consciousness would have been in for a hot time of it. He couldn't have looked more alone, standing there. Oh, don't tell me about science, Frost said. I'm something of a scientist myself. Bet you didn't know that. Botany. You boys know what tropism is. It's what makes a plant grow toward the light. Everything aspires to the light. You don't have to chase down a fly to get rid of it. You just darken the room, leave a crack of light in a window, and out he goes. Works every time. We all have that instinct, that aspiration. Science can't, dim? Science can't dim that. All science can do is turn out the false lights so the true light can get us home. Mr. Ramsey began to say something, but Frost kept going. So don't tell me about science, and don't tell me about war. I lost my nearest friend in the one they call the Great War. So did Achilles lose his friend in war, and Homer did no injustice to his grief by writing about it in dactylic hexameters. There have always been wars, and they've always been as foul as we could make them. It's very fine and pleasant to think ourselves the most put-upon folk in history. But then everyone has thought that from the beginning. It makes a grand excuse for all manner of laziness. But about my friend, I wrote a poem for him. I still write poems for him. Would you honor your own friend by putting words down anyhow, just as they come to you? With no thought for the sound they make, the meaning of their sound, the sound of their meaning. Would that give a true account of the loss? Frost had been looking right at Mr. Ramsey as he spoke. Now he broke off and let his eyes roam over the room. I am thinking of Achilles' grief, he said. That famous, terrible grief. Let me tell you, boy, something. Such grief can only be told in form. Maybe it only really exists in form. Form is everything. Without it, you've got nothing but a stubbed toe cry. sincere maybe for what that's worth, but with no depth or carry, no echo. You may have a grievance, but you do not have grief. And grievances are for petitions, not poetry. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure, but thank you for having a go at it. You wouldn't have guessed, seeing Mr. Ramsey settle back with a smile, that he'd just been stepped on by Robert Frost in front of the whole school. He had been my fifth-form English teacher, and though I hadn't liked him, I did find him interesting, just as I'd found his question to Frost interesting. But many of his students thought him a sood for his high diction and his passion for complicated European writers. They had surely enjoyed this little show. The headmaster led us in a last storm of applause. Then we filed out of the chapel into a hard, freezing wind. I asked George if he was headed to Blaine Hall, since it was rumored that Frost might drop by there for a cup of mulled cider with the English club. "Nah," George said. "He was going back to his room." "Why? Scared he'll give you the business?" "He was just teasing you, George." He shook his head. "Mr. Frost really thinks my poem is some kind of mockery of his work." "Well, he's the one who chose it. If it bothered him, why would he do that?" "I don't know why Mr. Frost chose my poem," he said, "but he seems out of sorts about it." "What the hell? You can clear things up with him at your audience tomorrow." "If I have my audience." "What, you think he'll blow you off?" "I didn't say that." "George, hold up. Hold up." We stopped on the path. The line of boys shuffled past us. A derelict kite flapped frantically in a tree. George looked away from me, back to the wind, tweed hat pulled low on his head. "I think I'm coming down with something," he said. "George, you can't stand Robert Frost up." "It wouldn't count as standing him up if I was in the infirmary." "You chicken shit. You big baby." George hunched deeper into his coat, hands jammed in the pockets. "You can't do this," I said. "This is something special, something to tell your kids about, your grandkids." "He won't mind. He'll be glad." "George, George, this is really dumb. Where are you supposed to meet him anyway?" "Headmaster's parlor. When?" "After breakfast," George said, then turned and looked at me. "Why?" "Just wondered. Are you really going to back out?" "I don't know." "What a waste." We walked along to where the path forked. "Come over to Blaine," I told him. "We can talk it over." He shook his head. "It'd be a complete waste if you backed out. I mean, he's here, George. Robert Frost. The chance of a lifetime. He's, what, 86, 87? It's now or never." "I understand that. So are you really backing out? Because if you are, there's no point in letting a chance like that go to waste." I saw him begin to understand me. "This has nothing to do with you," he said. "I'm just saying, why throw a chance like this away? He's willing to spend some time with one of us. If you won't meet with him, let somebody else." "Like you?" "Sure, why not?" "You'd be willing to take my place?" "Yes." "But he didn't choose your poem, he chose mine." "So? If you won't meet him, why not me?" "Because you didn't win." "I won, that's why not." "Would you actually accept an honor you didn't earn?" "Oh, like you earned it with those rhymes of yours. Please, we're not talking about Paradise Lost here." George looked at me with cold curiosity. It unsettled me, but my blood was up, and I couldn't stop myself. "Would I accept a meeting with Robert Frost?" I said. an unearned meeting as opposed to an earned meeting like yours? You bet your sweet ass I would.
George turned and started across the quad. I followed.
Are you backing out or not?
He didn't answer.
Wait till he gets you alone, you big baby. He'll chop you into little pieces.
I stopped and watched him bend into the wind, coattails streaming. Frost did not turn up at Blaine Hall that night. But Mrs. Ramsey did. Her solitary entrance put everyone on alert, like a song going up an octave. Faculty wives didn't attend such